Welcome to Module 8. This chapter is called Following Care Procedures. Being alert to special needs is vital. Objectives include explain how to measure intake and output, describe specimen collection, describe special care for residents with tubing, demonstrate proper application of bandages and dressings, demonstrate proper bed making. So we started on page 69, we're going to move over to page 70. So part one is documenting fluid intake and output. Fluid balance is extremely important for good health. First part reads, there's no single formula for how much water a person should drink. Needs depend on many factors, including health, activity level, body weight, and climate. So we're going to go in and kind of talk about some things such as dehydration, edema, why it's very, very important that what's coming into the body comes out of the body, and why it's our responsibility to track that. So intake is what's going into the body, and that can be through a plethora of different routes. That could be taken in orally, it could be taken in through an NG tube, but either way, it's whatever it's going into the mouth, and then output is whatever is coming out of the body, right? And usually we're referring to urination or defecation. So here it describes dehydration a little bit. This is basically when the body loses more fluid than it takes in, right? So when there's what we call a fluid imbalance, which means the body is at a deficit, right? So it's losing more than it's taking in. That's very, very important. And that can escalate from a minor problem to a very severe problem, right? You can go into a state of shock from low volume within the body, right? So we really, really want to try to avoid dehydration. It talks about some of the warning signs. You have kind of the earlier warning signs and then the later warning signs. One warning sign of dehydration that people don't really think about would be having a dry mouth, right? So if your mouth is becoming kind of tacky, dry, that's usually a sign that the body is entering into some state or level of dehydration. Another kind of earlier sign, dark urine. So having urine that seems pretty concentrated, has a little smell to it, it's usually a sign that there's not enough fluid in the body. When you start to get to things like lightheadedness, weakness, then you're starting to work your way into more of a severe illness. So we usually don't want our patients to even get there, right? A patient shouldn't be at a point where they're lightheaded, having a change of mental status, weakness, fainting, before we're addressing their fluid imbalance. And then also increased thirst, just being thirsty. That's the body's way of notifying you that you need to bring more water into the body. So it explains elderly at risk because they usually do not feel as thirsty as younger people. So we usually don't like to generalize a lot of things and say, oh, older people are definitively going to feel less of this or more of that. But when it comes to hydration, yes, their thirst sensors are just decreased. It does not mean that their body needs less water, right? Because remember that water needs usually is based on weight more so than age. So they may still need a certain amount of water, but again, they're not feeling that sensation to hydrate themselves. So that is why it is our job to make sure that we're offering foods and juices around the schedule, of course, as the resident's diet allows. But we need to make sure that we're thinking ahead, making sure this patient has had something to drink today, they have something to drink by the bedside, they're having fluids with their meals. Those are really, really important considerations for us. Then we have something called edema, which is when there's too much fluid in the tissues that can manifest as swelling. Mainly the swelling is gonna occur in the extremities, right? The portions that are kind of further away from the heart. So that's gonna be feet, ankles, and legs. It can also happen in the face and the hands, but typically feet and ankle edema you'll see the most. Heart and kidney disease as well can cause edema. So edema kind of happens when there's kind of pulling or shifting in the body system. It's where fluid is not in the right place, right? So if a patient has edema, which is kind of the swelling, it's not necessarily that they have more fluid than the average person. It's just that the fluid has shifted from the correct portion of the body to now it's sitting within the tissues and now you can see it. So usually the precautions or the considerations for edema is you want to make sure that they feel as comfortable as possible. And then also we can kind of work with gravity to decrease that swelling by kind of returning that fluid back towards the heart, right? So So this is why we elevate extremities above the heart so that gravity will kind of naturally assist with pulling the fluid back towards the heart and decreasing that edema. And then also just making sure the patient is wearing loose fitting clothing, because again, if you have the swelling and your clothing is not going to spontaneously accommodate for the bigger skin or the bigger body mass, you'll have patients who they're wearing the same socks they wear as usual, but now it's tighter and it could be restricting blood flow or just be overall uncomfortable. So it talks about special orders really quick. So NPO is the medical terminology for nothing by mouth, which basically means nothing should be entering into the patient's mouth. They may still be getting fluids, maybe through IV or NG tube, but it just means that nothing should be going through their mouth. There's a plethora of reasons why a patient can be NPO. A patient can be NPO because they're preparing for surgery, and they need to keep that airway clean. They could be NPO because they have dysphagia and they have trouble swallowing, so they're at risk for aspiration. They could be NPO because they're unconscious, right, and they don't have the ability to swallow properly. There's a bunch of different reasons, so you just want to make sure that you're following the care plan. If the patient has NPO orders, we are never, ever, ever introducing anything into their mouth. And we always want to double check, especially in the hospital setting, in the acute care setting. Whenever I'm in the hospital and let's say a patient's walking around, like, can you grab me some water? I'm always like, let me just check with your nurse, right? So I never know what's on your care plan, if you're allowed to have anything by mouth or not. Now we go over to measuring intake. To get an accurate measurement of intake, it is necessary to record all fluids taken by the resident, measure fluids taken by mouth, and soft foods that turn to liquid at room temperature. So that's ice cream, gelatin, and custard. The main important things about measuring intake is you want to do it as soon as it's consumed, and this really goes for a lot of our vital signs or things that we're documenting. You want to make sure that you're documenting as soon as you obtain a blood pressure, you observe a patient taking in fluids or a meal. You don't want to store a lot of things in your memory. You can forget, it can become very inaccurate. So we're recording intake as soon as it's consumed. Record water taken from bedside pitchers. So a lot of times, let's say you have a graded pitcher that has, a certain amount of ounces in there. If you fill it up at the beginning of your shift, a good way to track how much the patient is taking in, seeing that they're not in the position to go refill their own water, is to just see how much of that has been drank on your shift, right? So being able to subtract, you started at 700 cc's, you have 100 cc's left, you've drank 600 cc's in the matter of my shift or 8 hour shift, 10 hour shift, right? And then we want to record between meal beverages, so those are your coffee, tea, juices, just anything that's coming into the mouth. And then fluid measurements are usually recorded in cubic centimeters, also known as cc's. 1 ounce equals 30 cc's. However, 30 cc's is the equivalent to milliliters, right? So if you see 1 ml, it's equivalent to 1 cc. See 13 ml, it's equivalent to 13 cc. However, when it comes to ounces, then we need to do a conversion. We're going to go over to 71. So a measuring output, again, this is going to be a state scale, so you'll get a better visual of this with skills checkoff, but just the basic, right? So we want to make sure, again, it's really important that intake and output is as accurate as possible. And again, at the end of the day, it may not be you who's doing the official calculation, but someone is calculating to make sure what came into the body went out. So, for example, if a patient takes in 800 cc's of fluid in 12 hours and they pee 100, that's something's going on, right? They're retaining fluid somewhere, whether it's in the bladder, it's in other portions of the body, but that is not equal, and that can really affect patient's health, right? It could be that they have a bladder problem and they're retaining urine, and we need to address that so they can drain that out. Urine that is static in the bladder for a long time can cause urinary tract infection. It could be that they have some kind of pulmonary hypertension or some kind of cardiac process that's causing them to retain fluid, and that can overwhelm the lungs and the heart to where that can become a medical emergency. So again, it may not seem like much to, sit there and count what's going in and out of a patient, but it really all contributes to the overall health of the patient. So for measuring output, the main thing is we're going to make sure we assemble all supplies before we begin. Gloves, measuring container, you want an INO record sheet, or if you don't have an INO record sheet, anything to kind of write on so that you can transfer it to the proper charting system. As usual, you're washing your hands, you're putting gloves, and then we're going to pour the urine into a measuring container. And this is really, really important. You always want to put the container on a surface level, at eye, on a leveled surface, so that you can look at it at eye level. So if you think about when you hold fluids, it's kind of shifting back and forth when it's in your hand, so it's not very accurate. So you want to put it on a surface and get down, look at it at eye level so that you can measure it properly. You want to always make sure you're looking for anything abnormal in the urine. So we've talked about this before. We don't want to see blood in urine. We don't want to see anything foggy or anything that looks like discharge. It shouldn't have a really really bad smell or really, really just pungent color. So you're seeing reds or oranges or brown urine, that's going to be a sign of some kind of problem, usually related to the kidneys. Again, any sediments or particles, there should be no particles in your urine. If you're seeing that, the kidneys may not be filtering things properly, and again, that can be a bigger issue. Number six, you want to empty the urine into the toilet, put the lid down, and flush. Tidy the area, dispose of gloves, remove gloves, wash your hands, record output, report any irregularities. So hopefully by now, guys, you guys are noticing a system. I'll continue to hound on it, on how these skills are going. There's, regardless of the in-between of what the skill actually contains, you're kind of starting and ending most skills the same, right? You're always gathering supplies. You're always washing your hands. You're always putting on gloves. If it involves something that you're interacting with the patient, you're always explaining your care, providing privacy. And then at the other side of it, you're always making sure to dispose of supplies, dispose of glove, wash hands, and then recording anything that was done, right? That's going to be consistent for most of your skills. So when it comes to collecting specimen, we collect urine specimens, we collect stool specimens, we collect sputum specimens, which is basically mucus that comes from the mouth. And these are all just going to kind of differ based on facility, on how you're obtaining them. But usually they will be explained to you if you are in the position to collect that. So stool specimen, which is basically feces, this is something that, again, we've talked about before. We want to observe for consistency, color, amount, and odor. So stool, of course, is not supposed to smell amazing, but there are certain smells that do not smell like the average stool. Something that's just absolutely unbearable can be indication of some kind of infection. For example, C. diff has a very, very, very strong smell. So you want to make sure that you're communicating that amount, right? So if a patient is having, you know, 7 bowel movements a day and they're all huge and large, that's kind of concerning, especially if it's watery. Again, remember that water is lost through stool. So we do need to be cognizant of a patient's stool, because too many liquid or watery stools could mean the patient is losing a lot of water, even if their urine output is looking stable. Again, color, consistency. We never want to see frank red blood in the poop. So frank just kind of means in your face, right? Like frank truth. So bright red blood, that may be the sign of some kind of anal tear. Maybe some skin around the rectum is bleeding. If you're seeing dark stools, I would just go ahead and communicate it to the nurse. The consistency is going to matter. If you're seeing a dark form stool, that could be maybe a patient that's taking iron. Nevertheless, you want to communicate that. If you're seeing dark sticky stool, kind of looks like jelly, we call it tarriness, that's very, very important. That can be a sign of internal bleed, some kind of esophageal or gastric bleed, which is a huge deal. We don't want a patient casually losing blood through their stool. I've had patients who come into the hospital and have needed an immediate blood transfusion, and they didn't even know they were bleeding out, but they've just like, yeah, I've been having this dark, sticky stool for like 2 weeks now, and they've just been casually bleeding out through their stool. So that's very, very, very important. We want to make sure we're communicating that. For urine specimens, so routine just means, you know, your regular regular urination, whether a patient is putting it in a cup or it's in a clean bedpan or it's in a hat. Midstream clean catch, so this is usually when you're trying to collect some kind of specimen for testing. And usually if a patient can do a midstream clean catch, they're probably continent and they're able to do this on their own because it requires some kind of control of the bladder. A 24-hour specimen, this is a special collection. This is usually to analyze the function of the kidneys, right? So what will happen is for 24 hours, absolutely every single urine that is collected is going to go into this jug. It's like a dark orange jug. It's basically, it's going to sit on ice. It's very, very important. But every single stool, I think you throw away the first, sorry, not stool. You throw away the first urine, and then every single urine after that for 24 hours goes into that jug. After 24 hours, that gets sent to the lab, and then you do very specific testing on that, and it's for kidneys. But again, that'll be explained to you if they're ever telling you this patient's on a 24-hour specimen. This just means do not throw out any of their urine for 24 hours. So for sputum specimens, usually going to involve, if a patient is able to, they should be providing that sputum specimen, so coughing it up into the collection cup. If it's a patient that you're suctioning and having to transfer that sputum into the collection container, at that point that should be a nurse or a respiratory therapist collecting that. Over to page 72, we talk about dealing with elimination problems. Again, so we've kind of talked about when we're dealing with things like diarrhea and constipation and what that means. And then here, this is basically talking about the interventions that may be initiated to help the patient alleviate whatever it is they're dealing with. So if a patient is dealing with any type of constipation, we kind of take it step by step. We escalate it based on how severe it is. So the easiest is going to be a laxative, right? So a laxative usually can be something oral they can take. A stool softener really is the beginning, but that's kind of a preventative measure, right? Like Miralax is a stool softener. Miralax is something you take on a daily basis to make sure that your stools are consistently soft so that you don't get impacted. Whereas a laxative would be something like Senna or a magnesium citrate. That's something that's going to soften up the stool you already have in that movement and hopefully lead to a bowel movement. By the time you get into things like suppositories and enemas, the patient is probably severely impacted. And again, we want to avoid this, and this is why it's very, very important that we are tracking their output, right? So if we're noticing that no one has documented or it's not noted anywhere that a patient has had a bowel movement in greater than 4 or 5 days, we want to let the nurse know, right? So usually by day 3, 4, we should say, hey, the patient hasn't had a bowel movement, just so we can see, you know, kind of get on the ball, right? Is the patient on strong medications like opioid that's making them constipated, and they need to get Miralax on board so that they can avoid getting impacted? Those are the conversations we can have earlier on rather than getting to the point where they need a suppository or an enema. So it just explains here, suppositories are going to be ordered by a physician. It is a medication. So again, you should not be giving a laxative or a suppository. You may be assisting with the procedure or preparing the patient for that bowel movement, but that should be given by the nurse. A rectal suppository pretty much stimulates the bowel and lubricates the stool. So again, that should be administered by the nurse. Enemas, this is going to be kind of a water exchange. So you're pumping water into the intestines to hopefully rapidly pull that water into the stool and then have the stool come right out, right? Both enemas and suppositories, especially enemas, work relatively quick. A suppository, you may, you know, give it maybe a few minutes, some hours. Sometimes patients need multiple suppositories. But an enema usually is going to activate pretty, pretty quick, and the patient's going to have a bowel movement pretty much as that water is pushing in, the stool's coming right out. It's pretty, pretty effective. So for the procedure for the enemas, and again, a lot of times it should be done by the nurse, but just so that you know, I want to make sure that you have all of your equipment. That's going to include bedpan or commode. I'm getting prepared for that stool to come out. The enema kit, there's a specific kit. For the enema, it usually should be in a bag, and it has either medication in it, or it can be soap set enema. There's different kinds. You want some kind of lubricant, bath blanket, gloves, IV polar stand, because it's going to go by gravity, so it's going to be hung up. Again, this is why it's usually done by a nurse. Toilet tissue, waterproof, bed protector. 2, you want to wash your hands, put on gloves, of course, provide privacy, explain what you're doing, prepare the enema. Water temperature should never exceed 105, so that's our magic number. Clamp the tube in and lubricate the tip before inserting it. Position the enema back for use. Place a waterproof bed protector under the buttocks and place the bedpan behind the resident. again getting prepared to collect that soul specimen. And then we're going to move on to page 73, where we're unclamping the tubing, allowing enough solution to flow into the bedpan to remove air from the tubing. Ask the resident to take a deep breath. This helps. Insert the tube. If any complaints, you're going to go in about 4 inches. If the patient's complaining of discomfort, where you feel resistance, like you're pushing up against something, you don't force it, you stop there. Continue the enema until the whole amount of the enema has been introduced to the intestines. And then you clamp it and you wait for the magic, right? Help the resident to the bathroom if they're able to get up. You want to go ahead and assist them to the commode or the bathroom so they can have that bowel movement if they're able to make it there on time, or have a commode ready for a patient who is not able to get up. And again, it happens pretty quickly, but if you're in the position, you want to leave the room, give them a little bit of privacy, leave the call light near them, assist with wiping and pericare as needed, make the resident comfortable. Again, you're checking the stool to watch out for all the things we mentioned earlier. Tidy the area, dispose of equipment, remove gloves, wash hands, record as usual. Part three, caring for residents with tubing. So tubing requires extra caution and care. And though we may not ever really contribute to what's going through the tubing, we will have care for the general tubing, especially for how it's making contact or interacting with the skin. So for feeding tubes, we have things called nasogastric tubes, also known as NG tubes, and we have gastrostomy tubes. Those are two completely different things, right? So a nasogastric tube is going to be a tube that's going to be inserted through the nose and fed down all the way into the stomach, whereas a gastrostomy tube is going to be surgically placed, and it's going to be kind of a hole that's been made out in the stomach, so that food can go directly into the stomach. And there's a plethora of reasons why a patient would need either. Usually it means they're not able to get an adequate amount of intake through their mouth, and that can be short-term, long-term. So an NG tube is more of a short-term solution, whereas a gastrostomy tube is a long-term solution. So the main thing we want with both of this is you just want to watch for any irritation, right? So for the NG tube, we're looking around the nares, so the nose. We want to make sure we're not seeing any irritation, any skin breakdown. The gastrostomy tube, we never want to see liquid coming from around it. That could mean that the hole is looser than it needs to be, or it may not be compatible, or the actual tubing is dislodged or disconnected. So we want to make sure that we're looking at the site, making sure it's not inflamed, making sure nothing is seeping or oozing out of it. Those are very, very important. Going over to page 74. Now we have something called oxygen tubes, or usually we're dealing with a nasal cannula, depends on the setting that you're in. And this is going to be a tube that's delivering a certain amount of oxygen to the patient. Again, as a nurse aide, you are never titrating oxygen. That is beyond your scope. However, you are watching, again, for the care of the patient's skin, because a lot of times anything that's sitting up on the skin, right? So we've talked about pressure points, but also anything that's sitting on the skin, it doesn't have to be heavy, but the skin likes to be relatively free, right? So if you're going pretty much on a daily basis, you're wearing a nasal cannula around the clock, the small, tiny amounts of pressure, they build up and they can cause skin breakdown. So you're always making sure you're assessing the skin and making sure that there's no breakdown. And then again, oxygen can be very drying to the nasal mucosa. So sometimes you'll see patients with a little bit of nosebleed or blood-tinged sputum or blood-tinged mucus. Those are all things that you want to notify the nurse about immediately. For a catheter tube, so particularly with a urinary catheter, so this again is a tube that's going to enter into the bladder. Again, you will never be placing a catheter. That's beyond your scope. That should be done by a nurse. But you basically, it's a tube going directly to the bowel ladder to continuously drain urine, right? And there's a plethora of reasons, again, why a patient may need this. Sometimes it's for strict intake and output. So this is when it's so important that we're watching what comes out of that patient, that we're not taking any chances. We're just letting the urine go straight into the bag and we can monitor it from there. It could be for surgery, for short-term immobilization. It could be for wound healing. So if a patient has a really, really, really bad like pressure ulcer, sometimes to avoid even further skin breakdown or having them sit in their urine, they'll have a catheter in. So really, your care there, you may provide pericare with the catheter in place. That's even more important because catheters can be a huge source of what we call caudies, or basically a urinary infection, because again, anything that's being introduced into the body that's invasive can bring outside bacteria or pathogens into the body. This is why the placement of a catheter is very sterile. It's a sterile procedure, again, done by a nurse, but it's our job to also make sure that immediately, like right after the insertion, we keep it as clean as possible, right? Because it can kind of push in and out, and again, bacteria likes to travel and move up. So we don't want any bacteria sitting on the catheter because it can inevitably work its way into the urethra and then cause a urinary tract infection, right? So again, catheter care, as well as making sure you're documenting what's coming out. And again, these bags are see-through. You're able to see the urine that's coming out. Again, you want to document it. Make sure you usually can't really smell the urine that's going to a catheter bag until you're emptying it out, but definitely seeing the color, consistency, and if there's any sediments or anything like that, you can see that while it's still in the bag. For catheter care, should be done daily. Always check the care plan, make sure you have all the supplies. Really, really important, we always want to make sure the catheter bag is below the level of the patient's bladder because we want gravity to help that urine come out. Also, we want to make sure there's no kinks, right? So we make sure that the tubing isn't tied up somewhere or kinked because that's going to stop the flow and it's going to back up to the bladder and make the patient very uncomfortable. If you see that the urine isn't flowing freely or you're going in, let's say the beginning of your shift, there was 100 mLs in the catheter bag. Now it's 10 hours later, there's 150 mLs or it's the same. There has to be some kind of problem there. It's not draining adequately. Either the patient is not taking in enough and they're dehydrated, or the urine is backed up, or something's wrong with the tubing. So again, you want to notify your nurse about that. So general supplies, you're going to have a basin of warm water, soap and washcloth, hand towel, waterproof bed protector, bath blanket, and gloves. It's going to be kind of similar to general pericare. The next page, 75, you want to check the resident's identification, explain what you're going to do, provide privacy, cover the resident with a bath blanket, wash hands, put on gloves, place the bed protector under the resident's perineal area, expose the area around the catheter. Again, we're not trying to avoid unnecessary exposure, just the portion that's needed. Always checking the water temperature before we introduce it to our patient, making sure it's warm. Add soap to a wet washcloth. Some facilities will have specific wipes or antiseptic wipes that they want you to use for catheters, just because they're proven to be a little cleaner, a little more sterile. So just check with your facility to see what's appropriate. Eight, we want to gently check and clean the perineal area, report any sores, redness, leakage, bleeding, or other problems immediately. We've talked about that. We want to hold the catheter near the meatus, so this is basically closest to the patient's genitals. And then we want to avoid tugging on the catheter. We never want to dislodge a catheter. It's stabilized by a bubble being inflated there. So if you are ever being very rough or aggressive with the catheter and it dislodges, you could rip something on the way out because there's this kind of bubble in there to keep it from coming out. And we never want to forcefully pull that out. But we want to gently clean and rinse at least 4 inches of the catheter nearest the meatus, right? And we're always, always cleaning away from the area, right? So we're never, same way why we wipe front to back, we never want to introduce pathogens or bring pathogens closer to the entryway of the body. We want to take it away from it. For each stroke, change to a clean part of the cloth. This is similar to pericare. For 10, holding the catheter near the meatus, gently drive 4 inches of the catheter, moving away from the meatus. So remember, for everything that we wash, we rinse and we dry, right? Check that the tubing is placed correctly and taped securely. Remove the bed protector and bath blanket and cover the resident. Make the resident comfortable and check that the catheter and tubing are not pulling or kinked. Put the collet within easy reach. Clean the area, remove gloves, wash hands, record details, report anything unusual. The usual. Going over to other tubes and appliances. So these are things that, again, it depends on the setting. A rectal tube is something you're usually going to see maybe in the ICU setting, or like a step down or PCU. It's not something you're going to see long term, but it's basically the stool equivalent of a urinary catheter. So this is going to be collecting fecal matter. Usually the stool has to be somewhat loose or it's not going to travel down. So again, it's going to be special precautions. And again, you won't see it in every setting. You'll again just help with the carrying of the tubing, providing any pericare, especially after a bowel movement, because sometimes it can kind of leak out and around, right? An ostomy is any surgical procedure that provides an alternative route to the to eliminate body waste. So I don't know if we talked about a gastrostomy. So it depends on the name is going to correlate with the portion of the body, right? So we have a colostomy and we have an ileostomy, and these are basically two different collection devices that are going to collect waste, right? So it's basically going to catch it before it makes its way to the rectum. It's going to be somewhere in the colon, somewhere in the intestines, right? And ostomy care generally is a nurse's responsibility. If anything, you're just looking at the consistency, observing, making sure that you're reporting if there's any leakage, if things are leaking around, kind of the same thing with like a gastrostomy tube or G-tube. We always want to report any leakage, report the stool that's coming out, or if the patient is complaining that nothing is coming out. Usually patients with a colostomy, especially if they've had it for many years, are very familiar with the care for it and what's normal for them. We'll go over to page 76, applying bandages and dry dressings. Always wash your hands and use precautions when handling bandages and dressings. So this one is tricky because usually dressings and bandages, most of them should be applied by nursing staff. Sometimes it's even done specifically by a wound care nurse. That's how special it can be. If anything, you may apply like a typical bandage, like a Band-Aid, that's appropriate, as well as maybe some kind of silicone dressing that is preventative. So let's say you have a patient in the hospital setting and they now have kind of these, some of them are called Mepilex or silicone dressings that you can put to the sacrum, which is a known, you know, dangerous or sensitive pressure point, so that we can kind of stay on top of a patient getting a pressure ulcer or kind of being proactive. That's not anything that, as long as a wound hasn't developed and it's preventative, as a nurse, you should be able to apply it. But if it's not a preventative measure and there's actually a wound or a sore being treated, that needs to be handled by the nurse. Going over to part five, making beds. A properly made bed adds to the resident's comfort and well-being. Again, this will be fleshed out during skills, but basically I'm going to go through the difference between making an unoccupied bed and an occupied bed. Making an unoccupied bed is how you make your bed at home, right? You're not in it. You're standing up and you're removing the linens and putting it on appropriately. What takes a little more skill is how to make an occupied bed, which is a bed that someone is in, right? So we're going to skip over to that. And again, we're doing all this because, of course, we want patients to, you know, be in a comfortable bed, and a wrinkle-free bed is very, very important because those wrinkles can also over time affect the quality of the skin and create little points of pressure. So going down to making an occupied bed on page 77, get up if needed. Again, this is not always super easy, especially if your patient can't assist you by rolling. You may need someone to help roll them side to side. Explain to the resident what you're going to do, provide privacy, loosen the bed linen, leaving the top sheet to cover the resident. With the far side roll up and locked, gently roll the resident away from you toward the far side. Again, if the patient's able to assist, then you'll have them help to roll over. Again, very, very important, making sure bed is locked, side rolls are up, especially on the side that they're rolling towards. That is huge. You never want to roll a patient over to a side where the bed rolls are down. They could roll right off of the bed, right? Number five, roll the used linen toward the resident and tuck the linen under his or her back. So this is very important. This is basically how we're able to construct this, is that we're going to kind of facilitate everything under the patient. So tucking both the new and old under the patient, rolling them over, and we're going to unravel it on the other side, right? Raise the side roll where you've been working, move them to the opposite side, have the patient roll over to the other side. Then you're going to, on the other side, remove both the dirty and pull out the clean, right? So it's basically a tuck and roll type of situation. It says place the clean top sheet over the resident, pull the soiled sheet from below, keeping the resident covered. Make a toe pleat, replace the blanket and bedspread, and change the pillowcase. Position the resident, put the side rail down, and place the call signal within easy reach. Dispose of any used living properly. So summary for this chapter, nurse aid care procedures include everything from maintaining fluid balance to making beds correctly. Decisions for treating elimination problems are often based on the nurse aide's observation and records. Extra care, caution, and cleanliness are required for residents with special tubing. Nurse assistants apply bandages and dry dressings to promote healing and prevent infection. And going over to page 78, you have a review again. So going through, test your knowledge. What is edema? What are some procedures for measuring intake and output? What are some precautions for making an occupied bed? Explain some guidelines for dressings and bandages. And then five or more important points regarding care of tubes. So work your way through that. And that completes day two. We will see you guys on day three.